Good afternoon. Welcome to the Cato Institute. My name is John Samples. I'm director of the Center for Representative Government here at the Cato Institute. And again, welcome to our book forum today on The Quotable Jefferson, a new book from Princeton University Press, edited by our guest, John P. Kaminsky. Let me give you basically an idea. Many of you are no doubt are familiar with how our book forums proceed, but let me give you a basic idea. We'll hear from our editor about the book for a bit, and then our commentator today, Dr. Matthew Spaulding from the Heritage Foundation, will give us his views. And then we'll have a question and answer session that goes to the heart of the book and the heart of this remarkable man, Thomas Jefferson. Thereafter, we will decamp around 1:30 or so upstairs for lunch. And also, as you may have noticed, copies of The Quotable Jefferson will be available for sale, and Professor Kaminsky will be happy to sign the book also. I would notice in passing, it's a very good price, priced very nicely for such a substantial book by an important framer and founder of American political life. No one could doubt really the importance of framers and the founders of America. If you look at the book markets in the United States over the last few years, there are many books on Adams, books on Jefferson and so on, and they all sell very well. And of course, daily life and daily political life in the United States is affected by the founding ideas of this country. Only in the last couple of weeks, for example, a Supreme Court decision came down in an important campaign finance case, which included a dissent from John Paul Stevens. The case involved spending limits enacted by the state of Vermont, and they were struck down by the court. Justice Stevens thought very much that they should have been upheld. And part of the reason why he held that view, that is, that the government should be able to put restrictions on campaign spending, the government of Vermont, was included in his dissent. He said, quote, "I am firmly persuaded that the framers would have been appalled by the impact of modern fundraising practices on the ability of elected officials to perform their public responsibilities," unquote. In other words, Stevens argued, channeling the framers, the framers themselves would have lauded the campaign restrictions, the restrictions on spending, even in an area that no one doubted involved fundamental political rights. One thinks immediately of Thomas Jefferson, as one does so often. Jefferson said, quote, "The natural progress of things is for liberty to yield and government to gain ground." That in a letter to Edward Carrington in 1788. Jefferson, unlike Stevens, was not praising the natural progress of things, of government, and of the yielding of liberty. He believed, as we know, in individual liberty, natural rights, and limited government. We are here at the Cato Institute today. We could just as aptly have been at the Jefferson Institute. And today we're here to introduce you and to make the general public more aware of this fine new book, The Quotable Jefferson, which is indeed the most comprehensive and authoritative book on Jefferson quotations ever published. It draws primarily on the papers of Thomas Jefferson published by Princeton University Press. Professor Kaminsky has carefully collected and arranged Jefferson's pronouncements on almost 500 subjects, ranging from the profound and the public, the Constitution, to the personal and the peculiar, cold water bathing. So if you need some advice on cold water bathing, you also will want to have a copy of this book. The Quotable Jefferson is the first book to put in Jefferson's words in context with a substantial introduction, a chronology of Jefferson's life, the source of each quotation, and an appendix identifying Jefferson's correspondence and a comprehensive index. If Jefferson said something memorable about a topic, you are likely to find it here. The man who has done this service for us, John P. Kaminsky, is the founder and director of the Center for the Study of the American Constitution in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is director and co-editor of the documentary History of the Ratification of the Constitution, which has 19 volumes to date. He has written or edited 16 other books, including three on Thomas Jefferson, one that I would mention in particular, Thomas Jefferson, Philosopher and Politician, appeared in 2005. Please join me in welcoming Professor Kaminsky.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, the Cato Institute. It's always a pleasure to talk about Thomas Jefferson. I have known Mr. Jefferson for a long time. It was maybe about 10 years ago or so I was speaking to a group of support staff for judges, and the person introducing me asked me if there was something more that she would like me to tell, that I would like her to tell to the audience. And I said, well, you might tell them that I've been living in the 18th century for the last 35 years. And that's pretty much what I have been doing, working on the documentary history of the ratification of the Constitution. This is a project that's been going on for over 50 years now. It'll take us about 65 years to document what the framers did in 4 months and what the American people did in 9 months. But it will take us about 65 years to document that. And we've gathered together approximately 100,000 documents, copies of documents, and we're publishing those right now. In the course of doing that, I've gotten to know the Founding Fathers very well. I read their letters every day. That's part of my job. In fact, in 1986, I was offered the job of doing the Edison papers, editing the Jefferson papers at Princeton University, and turned it down. Only about 5 years ago, I was again offered the job, the new Jefferson papers, the retirement series at the University of Virginia. Would I do that? My wife thought that was a good idea. She said, however, it would be a long commute for me to get home in Madison. She wasn't going to go to Charlottesville, and so I decided maybe I wouldn't go to Charlottesville either. I've gotten to know Jefferson very well over these years, and I'm sure most of you in the audience know Jefferson pretty well, too. He's one of the most widely quoted of the Founding Fathers. He is also one of the most admired and one of the most condemned. One of the reasons why he's one of the most condemned is he does put things in writing. Others of the Founding Fathers don't put damning material in their writing. A man like James Madison, for instance, isn't going to be criticized as much on some of the issues that Jefferson is criticized on, slavery being one, largely because Madison doesn't talk so forthrightly about the issue. Jefferson has run hot and cold throughout our history. I think we're in a period of time right now where both spigots are on. He's running hot and running cold, both. And people have their objection to him. But he is interesting to look at. Partly because of his writing. People ask me all the time about David McCulloch's book and Ron Chernow's biography of Hamilton. I give seminars to federal judges all around the country, usually 10 or 12 of these a year, and the judges have read these biographies, and they ask me, what do I think about them, about this 18th century material not being written by 18th century scholars, and in fact, sometimes not even historians. And I say often what happens is that good writing covers a multitude of sins. And I think that's true. You can see in David McCulloch's writing, he's a wonderful writer, but he's just not an 18th century historian. And so there are many, many errors of omission more than commission that are in his book. This is true with Jefferson. His writing, the style of his writing, the fact that he abandons the purists when it comes to grammar. He's more interested in style and how a sentence sounds when he writes it. That's what he's getting at. That good writing that we get from him is what has come down through the years. When you look at what I think is the single most important sentence in the English language, it was written by Thomas Jefferson. we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, Jefferson didn't believe that, quite literally, at the time. The American people, when they read that, they didn't believe that either. It was a goal, it was a target, one that we're still trying to achieve today. Very easy for us to point our fingers at Jefferson and saying, well, look at his attitude toward slavery. Look at his attitude toward women. And yet today, we still have are faced with these problems, over 200 years later, and we still haven't reconciled our society to these issues of equality toward all of mankind. But that sentence, those words, and what Jefferson did in the Declaration of Independence, taking all of what had been written in the 17th century, 23,000 pamphlets in English history that documented the Stuart kings, the English Civil War, the Restoration, the Commonwealth period, the Restoration, and the Glorious Revolution, 23,000 pamphlets, another 5,000 pamphlets written during the American experience, the colonial experience, and he condensed that into five sentences, 202 words, the preamble of the Declaration of Independence. Just a remarkable achievement. And those words have come down to us throughout history, and they've been used over and over again. They've been used by abolitionists to achieve the eradication of slavery. They've been used to obtain the suffrage for women and for African Americans as well. They've been used in Eastern Europe to eliminate the grip of communist oppression. And so these words are what is really Jefferson's legacy, that we can be instructed by when we read them. We see what he has to offer. He's an imperfect human being, as all the founders, all the framers, were imperfect. No one's trying to suggest otherwise. We see imperfection in our modern politicians as well. I don't think that that means that we can discount what is there in the written legacy. And that's what we have in Jefferson's writings. Quite a few years ago, I had suggested to my publisher that we publish a little 2-inch by 2-inch book of Jefferson quotations, 26 pages, A to Z. He thought that was a good idea, that it would be given out at conventions to get people to come into the booth to look at the books that were being published. And so I started collecting these quotations, and they were just wonderful, and they were voluminous. And I said to the publisher, you know, this could be a 50-page gift book. And I brought along some wonderful quotations from Jefferson to his daughters, because I knew that the president of this publishing house had two daughters the same age as Jefferson's daughters when he was in France. And so these were wonderful quotations that appealed to him. And he said, oh, yes, let's do this. And then it got to be 100 pages, and then 150 pages, and they told me, stop, no more. I published with them Citizen Jefferson. It's a small gift book type collection of Jefferson's writings. And when Madison House was purchased by Roman and Littlefield, Roman and Littlefield was not in that kind of market, and so they did not want to expand the Citizen Jefferson. I had been collecting additional quotations throughout the years and was ready to come out with an expanded version of that book. Well, they didn't want to do that. And then Princeton University approached me about doing the quotable Jefferson. And that's how this book came about. They had a quotable Einstein, and this is the second in their quotable series. There will be others that will follow. When we look at what Jefferson says, some of the things are very profound. Some of the things are sort of silly in a way. Some of the things describe his personal life, as what John said about the cold water bathing. It sounds sort of silly, But it's not necessarily all by itself. It's in a letter that in two letters where Jefferson is talking about his lifestyle. What is his diet? What time does he get up in the morning? What time does he go to bed in the evening? What does he drink? How much does he drink? What are his physical ailments? And he talks about his illnesses that he had over the years. And he said, you know, I really probably have only had 6 or 8 serious colds in my life. And he's now, when he is talking about this, he's in his mid-70s. And he says, I think it's because every morning for the last 60 years, I get up and I bathe my feet in ice cold water. And that must have done something to help me ward off colds. So that's sort of an interesting thing. I haven't taken up that habit myself, so I don't know that it really would work here. There are wonderful things that you find in Jefferson's writings. You can see the kind of profound things that he writes, the Declaration of Independence and other areas of his public service. You see the things he writes when his wife dies. You don't get that writing with his wife because he, like Martha Washington, destroyed the correspondence with his wife when Martha Jefferson died. When George Washington died, Martha Washington destroyed all the correspondence. So we don't have that. But we're lucky enough that when Jefferson was in Europe, he went to England at the behest of John Adams for 7 weeks to try to do some negotiations with the ambassador from Portugal and a representative from Tripoli. And he saw a miniature press copy machine, an 18th century Xerox machine. And he made detailed descriptions of it. When he went back to France, he had 3 machines built for himself. One he sent to Madison, one he sent to William Carmichael, our charge d'affaires in Madrid, and one he kept for himself. And it's that copy machine that that we are fortunate enough that he had available to him when he met Maria Causeway, his new love interest in 1786. And we get, when she goes back to London, we get the exchange of about 60 letters between the two of them. And it's a wonderful correspondence. It's a correspondence that all the biographers of Jefferson look at because we see the real man here, the personal Jefferson. And he writes wonderful love letters to Maria. She would like more, not necessarily as long. She likes the long letters, but Jefferson says he can't write these long letters. He wrote the head and the heart letter. It's a dialogue between his head and heart. The head saying, don't get involved with people, especially with a married woman, but also with women in general. The scholar is happy going up to his cloistered room alone and being happy with your own studies. The heart speaks out definitely opposite to that and shows how to really be truly happy, you must be sociable. You must have contact and reliance upon others and offer them solace in their times of difficulty that you will receive also. And so we get these wonderful letters to Maria Causeway, which would not have been available had he not discovered this copy machine, because those are the only copies that are left. The originals, we don't know where they're at. So he kept Maria's letters, and he kept copies of his own letters. And so we have that kind of correspondence to see the inner Jefferson. We see the Jefferson the father instructing his daughters from when they're very young, very tender letters, also instructing them as to of their education and their attributes, the things that they will be able to develop over the years, because he told them 14 out of 15 chances you're going to marry nincompoops. That's the word he used, nincompoops. And so they had to develop their own intellectual activities, things that would stimulate themselves. He left two of his daughters in Virginia when he came to France, only brought Patsy with him. She was put into a convent, and only 6 months later, he found out that Lucy, 2.5 years old, had died, and so he called for Polly to come over as well. And he gave very detailed instructions. And these are the kinds of things that often come out in Jefferson's letters. You find a lot about how people lived at the time. These are not just personal. These are not just grandiose words that are written in the public forum. But, for instance, he instructs his brother-in-law how Polly should be sent over to France. It should be on a British or a French ship, not an American ship, because of the danger of the Barbary pirates. The ship should come over between May and August because of the danger of winter travel and the danger of hurricanes. The ship should have made one crossing back and forth, but should not be older than 5 years old. He says, you don't think about those things when you're on land, but when you're out in the middle of the ocean, you think about them very seriously. He told his brother-in-law, send Polly over under these conditions. If these conditions can't be met, wait another year. Well, they waited 2.5 years before Polly came over. And when Polly came over, Jefferson was on a trip to the south of France to investigate France, first of all, as minister to plenipotentiary to France, and also to get some healing to his wrist that he had dislocated on one of the last dates that he was on with Maria Causeway. He jumped over a bush or a fence, we're not sure. This little puppy dog in love, this 43-year-old courtier, and he fell and dislocated his wrist. And so this pained him throughout his life. So he was away when he got the word that Polly was coming. And he sent a letter to Patsy, just a darling letter, saying that she was going to have to give sisterly advice to her sister, given the difference in age, 4 years difference, and the mutual loss of their mother. Patsy would have to be the de facto mother. And he gave her instructions as to how to teach Polly, how to teach her to be honest, to be truthful, to be a hard worker, never to get angry. There's no joy in being angry and no benefit from this. He said to Patsy, if you teach Polly this, she will be forever admired by the world. She will be grateful to you, and you will have learned these traits yourself when you instruct your sister. And he told her, whenever difficulty came, always do the right thing. And he said, you will make someone happy who loves you infinitely. It's that kind of personal letter that is so touching. He writes to John Adams throughout his life, except for one 11-year period of time, from 1801, when Adams left Washington at 4 o'clock in the morning, would not go to the inauguration. Is one of the great events in American history, power was transferred peacefully from one opposing party to another opposing party. For the next 11 years, these two men were estranged from each other. And it was through the auspices of Benjamin Rush that they were brought back together in 1812, never to see each other, but they started writing to each other. It was in 1818 that Abigail Adams died. Abigail loved Polly, and Jefferson loved Abigail Adams. Polly had stayed with the Adamses in England when on her way to join with her father in France. The letter of condolences that Jefferson writes to Abigail Adams is just an unbelievable letter. I usually end my addresses on Jefferson with that letter, because you can't do anything after that letter. It's such an emotional letter. When I read that letter, half the audience is in tears. The first time I read it was in a retirement home. I speak to this one retirement home for the last 15 years in a row. And I was speaking on Jefferson, and they asked me the relationship with the Adamses, and I told them that. And then I had the letter there with me, and I read it. And I looked up, and everyone was crying. I thought, what a terrible thing. I shouldn't have done this. But not at all. When I finished, everyone was happy and they were pleased that I had done so. I think that what I hope people will get from this book here is the joy and pleasure and the sense of edification that we can all receive from a person who writes poetically. That's what Jefferson does. He is a real poet. And I think if you have an opportunity to read the book, you'll enjoy it immensely. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Professor Kaminsky. Our commentator today will be Matt Spaulding. Matthew Spaulding is director of the B. Kenneth Simon Center for American Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He's also an adjunct fellow with the Claremont Institute, and he has taught American government at George Mason University, Catholic University of America, Claremont McKenna College, and Hillsdale College. He's co-author of A Sacred Union of Citizens, Washington's Farewell Address and the American Character. And he's the editor of the Founders Almanac, a practical guide to the notable events, greatest leaders, and most eloquent words of the American founding, and notably also the executive editor of the Heritage Guide to the Constitution. He's also on the Board of Academic Advisors at Mount Vernon and State. Please welcome Matt Spaulding.
Thank you, John, for your introduction and invitation to be here with you at the Cato Institute. Thank you, John, for your putting this book together. It's always a good thing to focus on the American founders, but in particular, it's interesting that in this time in which biographies of the founders are selling well in the popular sphere, that we turn and look at their actual words. Biography is in many ways the best way to teach history, and reading the biographies can be a very powerful way to evoke what they dealt with in their lives. But we have their words, their actual words, so that we can not only see their actions and understand their world, but actually see them thinking through these profound problems they faced in these times. Indeed, when we pick up a work of the founders and read their letters and their correspondence in the way that you've so nicely evoked, we can be there, as it were, and to think through the problems as well. I have to mention in passing that I have a great respect for what you've done, having put together some edited volumes of their writings. It's not an easy task, especially in this day and age when we want to be not only accurate and historically accurate to them, but also get a full breadth of the work of someone like a Jefferson. And with Jefferson, we're immediately attracted to, but also aware of, the extent of his knowledge and who we're dealing with, the breadth of the topics that he would write on and correspond about is an amazing thing, even in this day and age of computers and the internet. What he could address in very profound ways many times was amazing. And his correspondence is just beautiful. His ability with the pen is not to be slighted. You evoke the correspondence with Adams and Jefferson, which I think I would consider one of the greatest correspondences in human history, given the history of those two and how it ends so beautifully at their death on the same day. But of course, it's his political writings and his political words that in many ways are the most interesting today, and I'd like to make a few comments about those in a way that I think hopefully would shape some of our discussion and perhaps raise some questions, which you can clarify, since, as you might notice from my introduction, my expertise is actually more on George Washington than Jefferson, so I too am a student here. And when it comes to his political thinking, I think we do have to grapple with the fact that Jefferson is in many ways one of the most difficult founders to deal with, not the least of which is because his vast interests and writings cause us to deal with what sometimes seem to be confusions or contradictions or changes and things that might seem to differ between his rhetoric on the one hand and political reality. For instance, the distinction between his revolutionary rhetoric in time of the American Revolution, for which we must give him profound credit, but then his flirtations and dealings with the French Revolution and trying to make distinctions between them. The wonderful correspondence, I believe, later, post-American Revolution with James Madison, in which Jefferson and Madison correspond back and forth about how to bring about constitutional change. Jefferson, much more enamored with the notion of a little revolution now and then, and yet it's Madison, who his fellow Republican partisan, who has to moderate Jefferson and remind him of the importance of essentially the contributions of the dead, right, and of things like constitutions. And then, of course, we have the questions raised by Jefferson's very strong writings about constitutional construction, the role of judges. And yet, during his presidency, here we have Thomas Jefferson buying Louisiana, by his own admission, a great violation of his actual theories of constitutional construction. How we square these things between his writings, his beautiful writings, and his practical actions sometimes gets a little difficult. And I don't raise that as a matter of criticism, but more as trying to grapple with how we square the importance of his writings about rights and the principles of the American Revolution, and how, as a practical matter, these things are carried out. It seems to me, for instance, that Jefferson's writings in the time of the Declaration and the Revolution are not moderated by kind of Madisonian's emphasis on constitutional structures, for instance. That seems to raise some interesting things about Jefferson in terms of what he might have for us today. Indeed, it raises the broader question about Jefferson, whether Jeffersonianism in the American founding needs to have added to it things like Madisonianism, perhaps even Hamiltonianism, or even more broadly, Washingtonianism. I'm always struck with Jefferson by the fact that both Jefferson and Hamilton were in Washington's cabinet. And they fought vociferously, being the founders of the two first political parties. And yet it is Washington's prudence, if you will, his moderation, that affects both of them and makes them work under the constitutional structure to fight out their differences, not through the radical problems of faction and the passions of politics, but through constitutional structures. And it seems that both of them, Hamilton, who accused Jefferson of being the radical Franco-Francophile revolutionary, and Jefferson, who accused Hamilton of being the monarchist, both of them needed to moderate the extremes of their rhetorical arguments in favor of more of a constitutional approach. Indeed, I think the difference between Jefferson's early Declaration-era writings, passing through his less than successful governorship to his presidency, shows the profound distinction between his rhetorical writing, as beautiful and powerful as it is, and by the time you get to his presidency, a more rather moderated Jeffersonianism, which we see in his inaugural addresses. We are all Federalists and Republicans now. Having said that, I think that Jefferson makes three profound contributions to the American argument, for which we are greatly in his debt today. Indeed, they're the three things that he has mentioned on his tombstone. I'll just mention them in passing, and hopefully we can discuss them further. They've all been alluded to, I think, in some way already. The first, of course, is the argument of individual rights. And I agree wholeheartedly that the most important sentence written by Jefferson, indeed probably the most important sentence in the American experiment, is that from the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. The fact that Jefferson wrote that in light of his own thinking as an Enlightenment thinker, influenced by Locke and others, but putting it into what he called the context of the American mind, is for something that we are profoundly thankful. But that evocation of rights has to be squared with his ownership of slaves. It is true that in the draft of the Declaration, it did call for getting rid of slavery, and there are other things we can point to. But in the end, Jefferson concluded that we have the wolf by its ears. We can neither hold nor safely let go. Justice in one scale, self-preservation in the other. He put it off to other generations. The generous temperament of youth, as he said, shaped by the flame of liberty. But in the end, it is his words that led to the abolition of slavery. It was a promissory note, and he committed America to upholding its principles. Today, of course, we are saturated with rights talk, and few Americans seem to understand it fully. We are either too zealous of our rights, or we neglect them completely. I think Jefferson and a renewed emphasis on Jefferson helps to put us that in the right balance. Secondly, Jefferson's writings on religious liberty, strewn throughout his correspondence and his public writings. The importance of religious liberty to the American founding itself, of course, is extremely significant, and the founders never took religious liberty for granted. But it's safe to say that Jefferson, along with James Madison, were perhaps the most vigilant of the American founders. Jefferson's writing about the dangers of establishments and the extensity of European history and what that might prove or what lessons we might learn from America are extremely important. For Jefferson, religious belief was a matter of individual conscience, and it was a cornerstone of every other liberty, and its defense was crucial for the maintenance of free government. He was eternally hostile to every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Yet, at the same time, we see in his work as a legislator and as governor various laws and proclamations he made. Indeed, as president, while he did not proclaim national days of fasting, giving rise to the famous Danbury letter, he did attend church and services held in congressional buildings during his presidency. And, of course, famously wrote his notes in the state of Virginia, and can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that those are the liberties, that these liberties are the gift of God. And, of course, in the Declaration, these rights are endowed by their creator. Jefferson's emphasis on the importance of the separation of church and state at the doctrinal level, nevertheless, did not prevent what we might call a certain mixing of religion and politics. That is, he understood the importance of religion, respected it, tolerated it. In the American context, understood that it was an important shaper, if you will, not only of our character, but of those things that made liberty a blessing. And thirdly, Jefferson's emphasis throughout his writings about education. And here we see a profound twofold argument. On the one hand, that seems to be an argument for universal education. And he writes extensively about the need for education across the board at all levels. All levels of education and race and wealth. A universal argument for the need for education. Also an emphasis on civic education and education about rights, interests, and duties about men and citizens. But thirdly, within education, we see an argument for what we might call a selective notion of education, a sense of higher education, if you will. In many ways, in the American context, the first, I would argue, profound defense of higher education in the American political context. And here, of course, we extend our thanks to him for his work in founding the University of Virginia. Let me close by just making a few points about the debate about Jefferson, which I think is also interesting. In the broad swath of historiography, I think it's fair to say that George Washington was in many ways understood to be the centerpiece of the American founding and its argument for some time, indeed up to the American Civil War. But at that time, for various reasons, not the least of which is the fact that both sides in the Civil War claimed Washington as one of their own, Washington in many ways falls by the wayside. To be replaced after the Civil War by a debate in the beginnings of the progressive movement in modern liberalism between Hamilton and Jefferson. Hamilton being the mean capitalist and Jefferson being the apostle of democracy. And it's interesting, indeed, I think very important for our current debate, that the progressives, trying to mix Jeffersonian ends and what they called Hamiltonian means, thinking here of the work of Herbert Croly, essentially reshape both of them, both Hamilton and Jefferson. But Jefferson becomes, in many ways, the key figure that modern liberalism takes on as its own. Just witness the fact that in the works of Woodrow Wilson and FDR, Jefferson is the starting point, largely ignoring the other founders. But it's also Jefferson having dropped the baggage of natural rights and limited government. Jefferson is now the apostle of democracy, but also the apostle of the modern state, the modern administrative state. The fact that FDR is the one who created, or at least under his administration, created the Jefferson Memorial is only some evidence of that fact. And today, in the modern debate of American conservatism, as largely a result of the effect of progressive historicism, we, I think, too, have lost the influence and importance of the writings of Thomas Jefferson. American conservatives roundly talk about the American founders. They like to talk about the American founders and saving the American founding. But in many ways, it lacks a certain argument which Jefferson brings to us. And indeed, the recovery of that, I think, is important for the recovery of American conservatism and, as a practical matter, the American founding. Today, for instance, we argue about big government, about its size and inefficiency. But from a Jeffersonian point of view, I think government would be slightly different. It would include those arguments for sure, but would be more an argument about its moral effects, how it violates our rights, how it undermines self-government, indeed destroys the American experiment. That is to say that I think that the profound gift of Jefferson is precisely what we started off with, that sentence in the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson's evocation of natural rights and human equality as a basis of consent, and thus the just powers of government, is the centerpiece of this experiment in self-government in the United States. It is true that when he wrote those words, he was speaking of the American mind. This was not, it was Jefferson's pen, but he was speaking for the founders generally. The recovery of that principle, it seems to me, is central to the idea of recovering limited government. Because in this day and age, when we argue about constitutionalism and limited government, and particular policies, those are really empty arguments if, in the meantime, we don't recover this deeper and more profound truth established by Jefferson, namely that all men are created equal. And so I would just conclude by quoting Lincoln. Lincoln, of course, the great student of Jefferson, who was informed throughout his career by the principles of Jefferson. And I would agree when Lincoln wrote, "All honor to Jefferson, to the man who, in the concrete pressure of a struggle for national independence by a single people, had the coolness, forecast, and capacity to introduce into a merely revolutionary document an abstract truth, applicable to all men in all times, and so to embalm it there, that today and in all coming days, it shall be a rebuke and a stumbling block to the very harbingers of reappearing tyranny and oppression." Thank you.
Thanks very much, Matt. Before we go directly to questions and answers, Professor Kaminsky would like to say a couple words.
Well, I was very pleased with the comments made about Jefferson. I just thought I might elaborate a little bit to give you some extra information that Matt commented upon. I found that the best way to really look at biography is not to read biographies, but is to go through the documentary editions. There's no way that you can get the same amount of material in any biography as compared to when you go through the papers of Jefferson, and you see what he's writing to people and what they're writing to him on a daily basis. When you see what Adams is writing to Abigail, when he's on the circuit in Maine in 1774, and no one will hire him because he's a radical, and he'll taint your case if you're a radical. If you're a government man, you don't want him. The only people that will hire Adams is people who want a great lawyer, and they need a great lawyer. But he's writing home once, twice, sometimes three times a day to Abigail. And it's a wonderful correspondence. When you read that kind of correspondence, you really get to know the individuals personally, a kind of way that you really don't when you read a biography, even the best of the biographies. Matt mentioned about Jefferson writing to all these people around the world. He wrote to the leaders in different kinds of fields. I listed in the front of the introduction the things that Jefferson did. And I think there are about 58 different things that he was expert in. And he used the vocabulary of these sciences. English was the language, but he used the special vocabulary. He was attuned to it, and he could write to the experts throughout the world. And so it's a wonderful thing that you see. Matt referred to he supported these little rebellions now and then. What's a reason? He felt that government was always a dangerous thing. And what he hoped for would be that people would stand up every once in a while, and they would alert government, you've gone too far. And eventually they would be put down. Not very seriously, Jefferson hoped, but it would be a signal sent to government that you've gone too far. You should look at what you're doing, your policies. He felt that this was true in France, and he wrote the Adam and Eve letter. I mentioned there are various letters that he writes that are given metaphorical names. The Adam and Eve letter is one of the most radical of the letters that he wrote, and he wrote it to William Short, the chargé d'affaires in France, his adopted son, saying, don't write me any letters like this, giving me the details of the Reign of Terror. It's only helping Alexander Hamilton. Stop with this writing. And he says many guilty people were executed without trials, and many innocent people were killed as well. My friends, they must be considered, and they would consider themselves as soldiers in a war. And he said, Pol Pot couldn't have said it any better, if it would take the destruction, the death of every individual except for one Adam and one Eve in each country, it would be worthwhile to preserve democracy. That was a very, very wild statement. It was only said one time, but it was for effect. He buys Louisiana territory. There's some problems with this, that he felt that this was maybe not constitutional. Well, Jefferson believed that an executive, a responsible executive, should in fact violate the Constitution on rare occasions, very rare occasions, when necessity required it. And then what you do is you appeal to the public. You admit what you did was wrong from a constitutional point of view. But as we've been taught later on, the Constitution should not be a suicide pact. The Constitution should not be there to straitjacket us when the goal that's right before us is so overwhelmingly wonderful and opportunistic that the president in this case should in fact violate the Constitution. But in that was his judgment, maybe, that he was doing it. Wasn't assured of that, but the Senate confirmed the purchase of Louisiana by its vote. There's a reference, Matt referred to George Washington several times, and I didn't mention that the last 100 pages of this book is taken from a database that I've been collecting for the last 8 years called The Founding Fathers on the Founding Fathers, what they said about each other, looking at things like character, mannerisms, physical description. And there's probably about 60 pages or so Jefferson describing his contemporaries, and then maybe another 40 pages or so Jefferson, his contemporaries describing Jefferson, and then Jefferson describing himself. And one of the best letters of all in that is Jefferson in 1814 describing Washington. And the character of Washington is just an unbelievable letter. I would advise you all to get a copy of it. And one is right here for you if you want to read it. It's just a fantastic letter. He describes Aaron Burr as a crooked gun, which in our term, would be a loose cannon, just untrustworthy. You don't know where it's going to go. Matt mentioned Constitution writing. Jefferson and Madison wanted to rewrite the Virginia Constitution, but they had that enemy down there in the south side of Virginia, Patrick Henry. And Madison wrote to Jefferson in Paris, is this a good time, 1787, when we're adopting the federal constitution, is this a good time when we should revise the Virginia Constitution? Jefferson wrote back, no, Patrick Henry's too strong. All we can do is pray for the death of Patrick Henry. Matt mentioned the slavery issue and what a terrible thing it was, and Jefferson wrestled with this, and Matt was right on line, except for one thing, one mistake that Matt made, and that is a mistake that has been made over and over and over again by historians, because it was made the first time and no one checked. The wolf. Slavery is described as a metaphor. We have the wolf by the ears. We don't want to hold him, and we can't let him go. If you go back to the original, it's quite clear. It's we have the wolf by the ear. John Miller wrote a book called Wolf by the Ears, the wrong metaphor that was there. Similar, but not the right, the exact right thing. Jefferson wrote about his early life, and he said, I read voraciously, and I... copy-placed everything. What does copy-place mean? It means he kept a book on everything he read, whether it would be Locke, and he transcribed the important sections of Locke, and he could go back to that. Historians, again, have drawn upon that, and they said, they wrote Jefferson's letter, and he said, it was, over the course of years, it has been my pillow. Well, Jefferson used pillow as a metaphor quite frequently, but not in this regard. If you look at the letter, you'll see it's not pillow. He says, I read voraciously and I commonplaced everything. It has been my pillar. It has been my strength, not my pillow. And so sometimes these errors get perpetuated in writing. I think that metaphors are very important in Jefferson's writings. And in fact, I convinced the production editor at Princeton University that in the index I should have the entry metaphors and similes used by Jefferson. She didn't think that was a good idea at first. I gave her a sample. She loved the sample, and now there are over 300 sub-entries under metaphors and similes used by Jefferson in the book. He uses, I said, pillow. When he talks about the hereafter, is there life after death? He says, I thought about this a long time when I was a youth, and I came to the conclusion that I could never come up with the answer. And I thank my Creator for giving me such a pillow of ignorance that I don't have to worry about this. So pillow is important. I think one of the most important, his favorite metaphor, is the word bosom. He loves the word bosom. It's far more maternal than sexual. He talks about the bosom of his family, the bosom of his books, the bosom of his farm. He talks about bosom friends. He talks to von Humboldt about the people in South America be able to establish democracies after they overthrow the Spanish imperial governments. Jefferson says, not in my lifetime. They're children. They've been kept children by the priestcraft and by the Spaniards. Maybe in your lifetime. But he says, when I'm in the bosom of my grave. So he talks about the serenity of death using the word bosom. My favorite line is when he's writing to Maria Causeway. She's afraid to go out in the ocean. It's a terrifying thing for many people. And so she will never come to America. He will never live in England. And so he writes to her when he's going back to America. He says, when wafting on the bosom of the ocean, I shall pray it to be as calm and smooth as yours to me. Isn't that a wonderful sentence? Wonderfully romantic sentence. Finally, I'll end with the statement about education. Jefferson believed in a meritocracy, and he wanted free public education from early general education through college education, and that's what the University of Virginia was to be. That didn't mean that that was publicly supported. It didn't mean that it was, education wasn't there for others as well. But Jefferson definitely was wholeheartedly in favor of public education. Thank you.
All right. Now we would like to have some questions from the audience. What we will do is please raise your hand. I'll recognize you. Then wait until the microphone arrives so we can all hear your question. I'd also ask that you identify yourself and any affiliation you might have. And finally, please have your comments in the form of a question. You can direct them to either or both of our speakers today. In the back, please.
Ken Hoppala. Much has been made that George Washington freed his slaves on his death and Martha's slaves upon her death, but Thomas Jefferson only freed a few of his slaves. My question is, did Virginia pass any laws prohibiting manumission of slaves between the time that Jefferson died, between Washington died and Jefferson died, and or were Jefferson's slaves encumbered by his debts?
I don't believe that Virginia passed any legislation that changed the manumission of slaves, making it more difficult for Jefferson to free his slaves than for Washington to free his. Washington freed only one slave in his will. That was his valet, personal valet. If John wanted to be freed, he could be freed. If he didn't want to be free, he could stay on the plantation. In any case, he was given a pension. Washington's slaves and his wife's slaves had intermarried, and so Washington felt and was rightly was correct that he would die before Martha, and so he provided that once Martha died, all the slaves would be freed, rather than freeing some husbands and yet wives would be left in slavery, and so forth. And so when Washington died, it didn't take very long before the slaves realized that their emancipation was predicated on Martha's death. And it didn't take long before Martha understood that the slaves knew that. And so she freed all the slaves at one time, January 1st of 1801. She died then in 1802. Jefferson did have serious financial problems. And that's the primary reason why he did not free all the slaves. As you well know, the accounts of Sally Hemings and Jefferson, the latest scholarly position on that is uncertainty. We're not sure that Jefferson was the father of Sally's children. We know for a fact he was not the father of the first child, but a Jeffersonian could have been, and there's discrepancy as to whether it's Thomas Jefferson or Randolph Jefferson. And I think the scholarly community that is not being pushed one side or the other, looking at the evidence that's there, will come out in favor of Randolph Jefferson. And it's a lengthy argument that has to support this. But in any case, Sally Hemings was related to Jefferson. Martha Jefferson and Sally Hemings were half-sisters. And so these sons that were freed, the Hemings brothers, were at least nephews, maybe sons. They could pass for white, and they all had occupations that would give them a trade, whether that be a blacksmith, a carpenter, or French chef. So these are the reasons why Jefferson, I think, freed those few at the end of his life. He went out of his way to do that, and he could not free all because he was in debt by $120,000 at that time, which was a lot of money.
Other questions? Down here, please.
Mal Klein, Accuracy in Academia. Question. David McCullough's errors of omission. What is there on the academic side to fill that void, other than your own works?
I would say, you know, I'm not 100% behind Joe Ellis Joe has had some problems over the years, and he has taken some license in his American Sphinx book, which I think is the book that people would like to have given him the Pulitzer Prize for. But like John Wayne, he got the Academy Award for True Grit. I don't think that was his best work. And I don't think Founding Brothers was Joe Ellis's best work. I think what was his best work was Passionate Sage. That was Joe's first big book, and that was on Adams. And so that is a book, I think, that is a far more accurate book. Peter Shaw, looking at the personality of John Adams. There are two great books there. You can look at the correspondence between John and Abigail. It's now all on the internet, all 1,161 letters, the transcription on the left-hand side and the manuscript on the right-hand side, masshist.org/digitaladams. Therefore, all of you to see, you can go through the correspondence yourself. It's there. I'll give you an example of what I meant by omission. Adams himself and McCulloch falls in love with Adams, as any biographer falls in love with their subject. That's not unusual. Adams believes he did such a wonderful job in the Netherlands. He got this loan. He went there to get a loan, save the revolution. Well, what McCulloch mentions is, yes, there was one intervening action there, that is, Yorktown occurred, that loosened up the Dutch bankers in giving the loan. But that's all. Two other things happened. One was that the British pulled up Pearl Harbor. That is, they attacked St. Eustatius, the Dutch island, a smuggling entrepot in the West Indies. They captured over 100 ships. In essence, it was a declaration of war against the Dutch. So the Dutch didn't have to worry about going to war. They were pulled into the war by the English. And then finally, the other thing that McCulloch either doesn't say, doesn't know perhaps, is that Franklin, the nemesis of Adams, back in France, has gotten the French government to back the loan that is going to be obtained from the Dutch bankers. So the Dutch bankers are not at any risk whatsoever. They're getting wonderful interest rates, and the French government is backing their loan. McCulloch doesn't mention any of those things except for Yorktown and gives total credit to Adams, when really, without Franklin back there and without the British attacking the Dutch, it's unlikely that Adams would have succeeded.
I agree with everything you said. The thing I would add there that I find fascinating about these books currently being written about the American founders is the very obvious, over time, move away from academic writings into popular writings, and that most of the scholars who are doing some of the best work on historical figures, not just the founding, but now there's a resurgence of interest in writings on Lincoln, are largely leaving academic publishers and the confines of their academic life to write popular books. Now, part of it is there's a market for those things, and I grant that. Joe Ellis wants to make some money in publishing books, and he sees where the market is. But there's a certain freedom they get when they write that way. And I think that they, in doing so, are rediscovering, if you will, a what was really an older way of writing biographies, which is trying to capture as best they can the thought and action of an individual person, this particular individual, in a historical context, which is to say they study their statesmanship. And they grab at something, perhaps imperfectly, but they get something in that history that I think the modern academic thinking, which has kind of gone astray, is incapable of grasping, which is the importance of the mind of these individuals making decisions under particular circumstances, explaining it through their correspondence, justifying it in the times. So I'm actually very optimistic about this surge, if you will, of interest. And I would just point out that this goes back to the kind of 1970s, when you started getting a renewed interest in things like the Federalist Papers, works like those of Martin Diamond and others. It kind of begins in the academy, but then moves outward. And I think that is all very good.
I would echo what Matt says. It's been an unfortunate thing that the academy has decided to write to itself. And that has been a tragedy, really, has left the American public out, at least in history. In the 19th century, the historians who wrote our history were often, this was their avocation. They were wealthy men, and they wrote to the public, and they sold thousands of volumes. And the people read it because it was understandable to them. Nowadays, unfortunately, historians are writing to 400 or 500 of each other, and that's all. It's a terrible thing. I would encourage those who are writing for the general audience, and this means not just in books, but also on TV. We saw only about, 4 months ago, there was a two-part series on John Adams. And David McCulloch was the big talking head in this. And what we saw was the reunion of the family in London and then in Paris. That is, John Adams and John Quincy Adams had been abroad for almost 4 years, and Abigail comes over. And what you see is the scene in Paris at a big table with John and his two sons, Tommy and Charlie, and John has a compass, and he's showing the boy something. And then you've got Abigail with Nabby, Abigail Jr., she's talking. And then you've got Thomas Jefferson with John Quincy Adams. Well, the last two are fine. That is, Jefferson thought of John Quincy Adams as almost an adoptive son, and Nabby was there with her mother. The problem is that Charlie and Tommy were back in Massachusetts. They were not there in Paris. And so this is a made-up story. There's a far better story that could have been told when they got together in London. And when Abigail heard that John Quincy was there next door getting his hair done, and he comes in, and she doesn't recognize him. The little boy now is a man. And the man comes up and says, "Mama, Mama," and she recognizes his eyes. She said she wrote to her sister, and she said, "I got a letter from my friend," meaning John Adams, her husband. "When he found out that Abigail was there, he said, the next day I was 23 years younger." And Abigail said, "When I saw my son and my daughter, and I looked at them together, I didn't feel 23 years younger. I felt very matronly." That was a far better scene to show in the television than the incorrect scene of these people together in Paris when Tommy and Charlie were not even there.
More questions in the front here, please.
Patrick McNamara with Human Events. This is a question for Mr. Kaminsky. I guess in the theme of quotes, maybe you could talk a little bit about falsely attributed quotes to Jefferson. And I think in particular, currently the anti-war movement is quite fond of the "dissent is the highest form of patriotism" quote, which, as near as I understand, is not a Jefferson quote and maybe totally made up out of whole cloth. Did you find in your research other type quotes that are used or misattributed or total fabrications?
Well, there are. I haven't used that in my research. The way I did the research on this book, and the way I do most of my research, is going to the primary source material in the documentary editions that have been published, the new editions first and foremost, but then when they're not complete, go back to the 19th century editions, and there are several of them with Jefferson that I used, and then go to the originals. And then what I would do, how I found out that it's not ears, wolf by the ears, and how I found it wasn't, it was my pillow instead of pillar, is every quotation that I had here, I went back to the originals. And we're very fortunate that we have the founding fathers' collection, the American Memory, from the Library of Congress. And you can go and look at the originals on your computer screen. And those that I couldn't find there that were elsewhere, I was able to get the staff of the Jefferson Papers at Princeton to assist me to look at the documents and verify the quotations. And so I didn't have the problem of these fictitious letters, since I wasn't using secondary material. But definitely they're there, whether it be for gun control or whether it be for any number of subjects. People will create letters, and they'll use them, just as this one attachment you probably have seen on your own computer that talks about the signers of the Declaration of Independence and how they suffered so much. How many of you have seen that? It's been going around for a decade, and that every one of the signers of the Declaration, they suffered so terribly. And they give examples. Robert Morris ended up in debtor's prison. Well, it's true he ended up in debtor's prison, but not because he signed the Declaration. He's known as the financier of the Revolution. Many historians turn that around, saying the Revolution financed Robert Morris. And Robert Morris became a very, very wealthy man. His speculation was so egregious, however, that when the deck of cards, the fragile deck of cards of his credit fell apart, he became a debtor himself, but not because he signed the Declaration. So there's a lot of fictitiousness that's out there, and you always have to be aware of that. This is true of anything that's on the internet, and it's true of letters as well. There have been attempts to falsify letters. I haven't had that experience, primarily because I haven't been using that kind of source.
Please note, though, that the quote I used at the front of our intro, I did not make up. Although I did use a secondary source on it, I didn't see the original. Did you want to say something, Matt?
No, I was just going to point out, because this is true for almost all the founders, Tocqueville, there's kind of these spurious Tocqueville quotes. But what it really points to is the fact, and this is why America is so unusual, right? There's something about America in the fact that it was founded that requires current political debates to always go back and justify their actions in light of the thought of the founders. Hence the need for creating quotes or misusing quotes, which is probably even more the case, taking them out of context. I mean, American politics historically turns over precisely a debate about what the American founding means, right? This is what liberalism was all about. FDR, they wanted to reclaim it and to reinterpret it, so to speak. And so it just underscores, I think, the very importance of people like Jefferson, but also their documents and the other founders, the debates over the Constitution, which I think it just underscores the fact of the importance of making sure that, since that is the coin of the realm, so to speak, how important it is to make sure we know the right arguments, understand those concepts, are familiar with them enough so that when someone does quote the founders, we can have a sense about whether that's being done accurately or not, and the ability to go back and check. Because it is true that I think it is true even today that our politics ultimately does turn up on the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, which is why it's so hotly debated and so important to our future.
Gentleman in the back on my right. Microphone's coming.
Hi, I'm David Bowes with Cato. Matt Spaulding's reflections on the founders and the importance of the founding remind me of a question I've asked, I guess, rhetorically. So let me ask it as a real question to somebody who ought to know. What does it mean to be a conservative in a country founded in liberal revolution?
Do you want me to?
With special emphasis on Jefferson.
I think that is the question, and I agree, and I'm glad you asked that. I mean, I think what it means to be a conservative in the American context is to conserve the liberal principles of the American founding. That is the divide, I think, in the conservative debate is precisely over the status of the Declaration, the writings of the founders, and I think that it has to be grounded in a conception that recognizes a rights argument. Now, I think what makes it conservative as opposed to liberal is that the American argument, including Jefferson, their concept of rights is grounded in human nature. That is, it's moored into something, and it's moderated by constitutionalism, which is why I think you have to mix Jeffersonianism with Madisonianism in a way, right? But I think what conservative becomes essentially is a reclaiming, if you will, reestablishing a proper understanding of those principles. Or to put it another way, I think what American conservatism is not a defense of European feudalism, right, which is what Lionel Trilling and others always thought it meant in the 1960s, What it is essentially, it's a defense of the moderate Enlightenment, right? It's a defense of Adam Smith and Lockean principles as they then are laid out and play out in the context of the American founding, as opposed to, say, the more radical Enlightenment arguments, which I think go through the French Revolution and Rousseau and then to Hegel and the German thinkers, which are ultimately more problematic and much more radical and lead to the various isms of the 20th century. So that's how I would answer your question.
As I mentioned, I give seminars to federal judges all over the country. And I was in Kansas City about a month ago, and one of the judges raised the question, isn't it a sorry state that we're in when it's reported that only a very small fraction of the American public understand, know the five rights that are in the First Amendment? One of the more liberal judges took the opportunity and said, five rights in the First Amendment? I've been given 25 over the last few years. So we have an activism that's there that many people don't like to see. In Detroit, several years ago, in giving a seminar there, one of the senior judges came in at the lunchtime, left at lunchtime when he was finished, didn't stay for the seminar. Some of the judges said, congratulate him on a newspaper article in that day's newspaper. And it was congratulating this judge who for the last 25 years was running the city waterworks because the city couldn't do the job. And the judge made a ruling 25 years ago as to what was needed, and we haven't gotten what was needed in Detroit, and so the judge is still running the waterworks in Detroit. So I think there are certain founding principles that we can look at, certain basic facts that both liberal and conservatives can agree upon that is not functioning the right way today. That, yes, we would like people to know what those five rights are. We would like to limit the First Amendment to five rights and not many, many more. We would like judges to be judges and not administrators as they often have been of late.
I'd like to follow up and finish with a question that I think addresses the same question David Bowes has just raised. Pauline Mayer, in her book on the Declaration of Independence, as I recall, says that the words in the Declaration endowed by their creator, that if you look closely at Jefferson's draft, that the words by the creator are not in his original draft but were added by an editing committee later. And that it was done, you get the impression from the book, largely as a way to make the document more persuasive and to speak more to the sort of culture of the time. My first question, is that correct? Is that about Jefferson's draft and my memory correct about it? And if so, does it tell us something about Jefferson, that is, that in a sense he saw natural rights as being floating free of a kind of creator, that you could have a natural rights regime based on secular considerations?
Jefferson was a believer in God. He was a deist, and he certainly believed in the writings of Jesus. He felt that he was a Christian in the best sense of the word. He didn't believe that Jesus was divine, but he did do his cut-and-paste job and created his own Bible, taking the words of Jesus, and these are some of the best philosophical words that we can live our life by. When it comes to writing the Declaration of Independence, first of all, we should understand the writing of the time. We don't have the same rules of plagiarism back then as we have today. And in fact, there was the sense that you must build upon others. You cannot be totally original in what you're saying. You must build on others. And so Jefferson would readily admit that much of what was in the Declaration came from others. It was in the air, he says. His job was to give the right spirit and tone to it. It's hard to determine how that document was actually written. There are several different versions. The version that John Adams gives is that there was a subcommittee. He and Jefferson were in the subcommittee. And as they met, they worked out what should go in the document. And Jefferson said, "Mr. Adams, you go and you write it." And Adams's response was, "No, not at all. First of all, you're a Virginian. I'm from Massachusetts." Remember all the conflict they'd been in Massachusetts. Later on, when he talks about comparing himself to Washington, he says the same thing. He's from Virginia, and we know all Virginia geese are swans. That's not the case in Massachusetts. He says, "You're a Southerner. I'm a Northerner." He says, "I have everybody attacking me." He doesn't say these words, but he says it about Washington. He knew how to keep his mouth shut. The false teeth helped with Washington. He had false teeth that wanted to pop open all the time, and he had to keep his mouth shut actively so that they would not open up on him. I often say politicians should take that as an example today and keep their mouth shut more often. But Jefferson, as Adams says, didn't speak more than three sentences in a row in Congress. He was not the orator. Adams couldn't keep his mouth shut, and he angered everybody. And so he knew that anything that he would pen would be changed much more readily than something that Jefferson would write. And finally, Adams said to Jefferson, "I've seen your writing. You are a far better writer than I am." And I think that's probably true. Adams was not a bad writer. He was a very good writer. But Jefferson had this poetic quality about him. Now, when it comes to the subcommittee, Adams says, I don't remember if we did any changes whatsoever. Now, Pauline Meyer would like that others contributed to this. There were similar declarations by towns throughout New England, and Jefferson was using some of this. He said, "I didn't have any one thing before me. It was in the air," and he was taking this and bringing this all together. I wouldn't be surprised if Jefferson didn't have the creator in there. At the end, I don't have the words right in front of me, but Jefferson says that we bind ourselves together with the hope that the creator will be supportive of us, and we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And I used to say to my students, take that sentence home and rewrite it. Do it better. And no one has written it any better. And I said it once to some judges, and a colleague of mine was there, and he said, "I could write it better." And I said, "How would you do that?" And he said, "I would write what Jefferson wrote originally." He didn't have the reference to God in the conclusion. That was put in by Congress. Absolutely no doubt about that. We know that that was put in by Congress, and Jefferson would have preferred that that not be put in, that it would be a secular revolution. And so I'm not positive about the first, but I wouldn't be surprised if Jefferson didn't have it there. But Jefferson was also, this was a political document, and he was appealing not only to the countries of the world in explaining the necessity, and he uses that word over three times, necessary or necessity, that's the key word that forced Americans to declare their independence. But he was also writing this to Americans. Perhaps half of them at this time didn't think that it was necessary and that this was the wrong way to go. And so he would bring all the ammunition he could in this document.
Matt, would you?
Yeah, just a brief comment. Mike, if I'm remembering correctly, is that the difference between the draft and the final, there's essentially five broad references to God in the Declaration, two of which are added later by the Continental Congress. I believe the Creator reference and the Divine Providence reference, but I'm not exactly right. But it did go through an editing. But what strikes me about that is that, from what I can tell, that's not something that Jefferson objected to. He was more concerned that they dropped out his references to a condemnation of slavery, for instance. But what strikes me about the Declaration, in my sense of Jefferson, but more broadly my sense of the founders, meaning those who were involved in this process and thought in these terms, was that they really thought they were making an argument that had that was kind of twofold, that could be acceptable from a point of view of philosophy, from a Lockean philosophy, but also acceptable from a point of view of divine, from providence, from a biblical tradition. And so you can read the Declaration either way. And I think that Jefferson, being intelligent and also writing a public document, wrote it that way. And that, in many ways, is the great fusion, if you will, of these great arguments of reason and revelation. Indeed, the fusion of modern political conservatism that makes it work. But I would just point out in closing is that the debate over those things does not neglect the fact that there was overall agreement and no objections to grounding the Declaration, with the starting point being the self-evident truth of human equality and rights. And that's the most important thing. The source of those rights, being from revelatory tradition or from philosophy, is a great and important debate, abstract debate, if you will. But in the context of politics, there was a profound agreement. And I think that's the virtue of Jefferson's writing, and also the great achievement, if you will, of the American founding.
On that point, I would like to once again thank everyone for coming today for this very interesting book forum, and to invite you upstairs to lunch, and also, if you haven't yet, to purchase a copy of The Quotable Jefferson. Thank you.